good afternoon. So, last time we were talking about two-phase commit, and we had this idea of getting consensus from all our workers and coordinators in a first phase about what we were about to do, and then agreeing to do it. And the key reason why this provided the property which we wanted, which, remind you, was this idea of a distributed transaction that everyone does something or doesn't, is that once we got that consensus, there was no taking it back. That each worker and the coordinator would remember their decision with a redo log, and sort of our key assumption was that in the case of sort of a worker going down, that that redo log would come back with the worker. If it didn't, we would end up, we mentioned blocking that. We couldn't make progress, and we need some sort of manual intervention. We have an assignment that is due next Monday, which is to implement a very simple two-phase commit case, where you're just changing one value together. Some people have observed on Piazza that in the assignment, because it's simple, we don't have some of the scenarios we talked about in lecture of like having a class being full being a reason to abort a transaction. It's trying to be the simplest possible case, which maybe misses some of the sort of issues we talked about last time with respect to, you know, can we really, you know if we're able to do this until we've contacted the workers. In the case of the assignment, you kind of do. In our examples in lecture, you might not. We also very briefly introduced the idea that, well, you know, if we want to handle redundancy, we can extend this two-phase commit idea to, rather than having, you know, full consensus, we can just require a majority vote or something like that and allow a system to keep working in spite of some failing nodes, provided that you sort of every node is interchangeable, that everyone has a copy of the same data, unlike with two-phase commit, where we didn't assume that. I didn't go into the details of how we'd achieve that, because those are actually quite complicated, mainly because you need to worry about things like, what if the coordinator fails? How do we still make progress despite that? So before I move on to today's topic, which will be first some one remaining distributed systems topic, and then to talk about a bit about security, any questions on the material from last time? Okay. So, brief logistics note. So, last week's post quiz is due and available on Thursday at 12:15 p.m. before this lecture time. Please do it. And two-phase is due next Monday, as per prior announcements. This is all in the emails, just mentioning it again. So, as our one final distributed systems topic, I'm going to talk about network file systems. So, when our department machines are working correctly, your files are always there. You know, even though you might log into one of several machines. So, for example, if you've used SSH into Portal or an X, there's actually several different machines which all, you know, serve those services, and you have all the same files on each of them. And how does that work? Well, there's something we call a network file system, that these machines that you log into, so, you know, the machines you, SSH into, actually all talk to a single network file server. And this is where your files are actually stored. So one sort of interesting thought exercise is, well, how does this communication look like between those machines and the network file system? And one way we can design that is we can think of our idea of remote procedure calls. And superficially, they seem like actually a very good fit. If we think about how a program actually, you know, accesses files, we're doing it with system calls. So one idea is that we can just take those system calls and convert them directly into remote procedure calls. So this is a very simple way we could implement a network file system. And this idea would work, but there's some problems. And because of these problems is one reason why, as we'll talk about later today, real network file system protocols aren't quite going to look like this. We're going to talk in detail about, in fact, a particular protocol called the Network File System version 2, which does use RPC calls, but they don't exactly map to system calls like would seem the easiest way of doing that. And there's a reason why. And this comes to when we think about what is the server here doing to make these work, and in particular, what information is it stored? And, well, this is going to be not a sort of performance issue so much as a, what happens when things go wrong issue. So we're going to mainly be thinking about, given this protocol, what happens if things go wrong? And to think about that, let's start out with the question of, to sort of frame our discussion of, like, what's going to happen if something goes wrong, like one of the machines crashes, about thinking, what does the server need to store? And if we think of this protocol, well, it needs to store the same sorts of things that used to be stored in the kernel for a local file system. It needs to store a table of file descriptors for each process. It needs to store some mapping from that file descriptor to the actual thing on disk. It needs to store the location in that file, whether it was open for reading and writing, and so on. So we have sort of the open file descriptors in each file, what file, offset and file. And there's also a question of, like, for this open call, do we have to store the current working directory? So one immediate issue is that what if we want to mix local and non-local files? Right. And this is actually typically the case on, say, the machines you SSH into. Your slash /u computing ID is non-local, but for example, there's a slash /temp directory, which is local. So we actually want some sort of abstraction layer, and OSs typically have this to support accessing multiple disks. So presumably the client machine is going to be responsible for the current working directory if only because it needs to deal with these local and non-local files. But then we get to, what about these file descriptors? Now, this is not that much information, but it kind of gets significant. People often want to use these network file systems with, say, let's say you have people with a desktop on each machine or a laptop, and it accesses this file system. So let's say, you have like a company with 1,000 people. So like say 1,000 clients, each of those machines is running say 100 processes. So that's like 1 million processes in total, each one with say, maybe 10 files on average. That's 10 million sets of this information. So that's a lot. It's kind of expensive. It seems like this might be make the server not super fast, but it's not actually that big an issue. It's something we could deal with. But the real problem is what do we do with this information when things go wrong? So let's start with the most common case where something goes wrong, which is what if a client crashes? So I have a client machine using this network file system, and it hasn't sent anything to the server for an hour. So question, can the server delete its open file information yet? So it hasn't gotten anything for an hour. Can it do that? And the answer is sometimes no. So can someone give me an example, a plausible reason why this would happen? Preferably in the chat. Your most plausible reason why you wouldn't be able to delete this yet. Why the client's still around even though hasn't sent anything to the server for an hour. Yeah, so maybe we just have a file open. So one possibility is we have a file open but haven't saved. Saved into it yet. So lengthy read. Let's assume this is sent or received or, you know, or acknowledged. So presumably if it's a lengthy read, we would solve that with acknowledgments of as we're like sending things in the connection. So client has the file open and is idle. Yeah, so we have a bunch of cases where the file could just be open for a while and the client has no reason to talk to the server. So one first round solution you might get for this is you might say, okay, let's have the server, have the client always sort of ping the server, you know, say, e.g., once a minute. So that's sort of the obvious solution to this question of like, it could be idle. But if you try to do that solution, you'll often still find that there's sort of plausible reasons why you wouldn't want to actually delete the open file information, even if the client is supposed to send something to the server, say, every minute. So as a hint, what if the client's a laptop? So one example is, you know, laptop in sleep mode. Oops, laptop's in sleep mode. It can't contact the server anymore. But when it goes out of sleep mode, we probably still want that to work. Another sort of example is walk too far from the Wi-Fi. We temporarily don't have network connectivity, but when we walk back where there's Wi-Fi, it should start working again. So these sorts of scenarios that we probably actually care about, and even with desktops, we have like, what if the network's temporarily down or the desktop goes into sleep mode and so on, you know, make it actually rather awkward for the server to just delete information of clients which go away. Because we don't really have certainty on, you know. So this is kind of a question of unstable connection. Yeah, so unstable connection would be sort of, or other unstable connection. So these are, you know, all kind of not nice situations. And it would be nice if the server didn't have to worry about this, because if we think of a server with thousands of clients, over time, we might get into these sorts of situations where we're keeping extra information around a lot. And if we have to keep it around like for days, you know, and that's actually plausible, I could put my laptop on my desk, go away for vacation and come back and expect it to still work, then, you know, that's kind of inconvenient. For the server, but, you know, maybe not so bad. Now, let's think about if the server crashes. So the server crashes, we restart the server, you know, the files are still all okay, let's say. You know, we have our file system with journaling, everything on the file system is great. You know. So question here is, what do the clients do? And in our model where we have just these system calls, well, you know, the server, the problem is probably the server doesn't remember file descriptors, doesn't remember FDs. And that probably means the clients basically need to restart because none of the applications they are running, which are using the network file system, can do anything with the files they have open. So that seems really bad. And question is, like, can we do better than this? So one idea is that you could maybe have the server remember state despite crash. But this now means that all system calls, sort of all the RPC calls, write the disk. To disk, which is going to be pretty slow. You know, if every open operation, even if the file is cached on the server, you know, you're mentioning like spending lots of effort to cache things, now it has to write to the disk, so it works bad. So we're going to have an alternate solution, which is going to solve both our problem with the server restarting and with the server being able to remember about keeping more information on the clients. And we'll look at what that is, but let's think about, like, what information should the clients keep around to make this easier? And we're going to go through a concrete example of how this works, and that is, as I mentioned earlier, is the network file system version 2. So this is a very old protocol. This was standardized in 1989, and it uses RPC. But the RPC calls they've chosen deliberately don't look like our normal system calls. And this wasn't because they didn't have those system calls in mind. This was designed for a Unix-like system with the Unix open, read, write, close interface. But that's not quite the operations they have. And they've made some particular choices to make these crashing scenarios work out better, and to also make the server simpler. So here are a subset of the RPC calls they have. So they have a lookup call, which takes a directory file ID. I'll talk about what these IDs are in a bit, and a file name, and gives you another file ID. They have a get attribute call, which is like stat that some of you have used in the FAT assignment. It gets you sort of size, owner, that type of information. They have a read call, which is kind of like the pread you have in FAT. You take an offset and a length. There's no file descriptor, which has a location. There's no seek. Write is similar. It takes an offset and the data to put there. And there's create, remove, and so on. So the notable thing here is that we're dealing with these file IDs rather than names. So what is the file ID? So if you're a client, so if you're making these RPC calls, from your point of view, the file ID is entirely opaque, meaning that you have no idea what it is. It's just some bytes that you need to send back to the server. The server gives you file IDs from operations like this lookup or create, and you just send that to the server, and you don't understand what's inside it. And the intended implementation of this is that the file ID contains the sort of information we were storing in the open file table. So if we vaguely remember when we talked about the file descriptor table, we basically need to say, this is the device with the file system, and for an inode-based file system, this is the inode number. So that's the primary thing which a typical implementation puts in this file ID. So the idea is rather than the server storing all the files the client has open, the clients are storing that information. And the server doesn't, you know, need to like look up the file name again each time. It just gets the information that it would have gotten from its table of file descriptors, you know, but the client stores that directly. So there's also this additional generation number, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. So questions on sort of anything in this sort of protocol before we talk about the implications of these file IDs. So if we think of having this, so basically in the client side, the client is tracking some file table itself, and it's going to track, you know, what server does it come from, the file ID the server gave me, and it also needs to track the offset, because you notice that we deliberately chose that we don't have a read the next 10 bytes call, you have to say read 10 bytes at this location. And the client is tracking this mapping, so the server doesn't need to store that anymore. So we don't need to worry about when do we delete the mapping anymore either, because we have what's sometimes known as fate sharing, that if the client machine path crashes now, our information about the open files is automatically deleted. The server doesn't have to do anything like figure out if the client's still running. Doesn't matter. When the client goes away, the information goes away. So you've conveniently gotten rid of that problem we had earlier of when can I delete this information the server is tracking for each client. And when the server gets one of these RPC calls, it just converts this file ID to a file on disk. And it can construct that file ID to make it really simple. That's why it was using an inode number. And this means that the server doesn't need to get involved except when the client is using the file. It doesn't need to track information about files that the client has open and so on, unless it's actually doing some change to the file. Questions about this idea. So in the file IDs, you may have noticed I have this generation number. And the reason for this is that there's actually a problem with this scheme. And the problem has to do, well, one way, thing the problem has to do with, what if we remove a file and you still have a file open? In this scheme, the server has no way of knowing who still has open a file that was removed. And the really bad thing about that is that we have this inode number that we typically use to track files on disk, and inodes are reused. Like when I remove a file and create a new one, I don't want to have to use a new inode. Eventually, if I do that, I'll run out. So our solution is that we're going to actually modify the file system to add a new field to the inode called a generation number. And every time we reuse an inode, we'll increment this number. So if a file is removed while a client has it open, it can send the same file ID, and it might be the case that its file ID for a removed file is the same in the first two parts. But that's okay because the generation number will be different. And this will let us know, hey, sorry, you tried to write to a file that was deleted, that doesn't work. And we can do something kind of sensible in that case. It's not going to be great because all of our cases of writing to a deleted file aren't going to be great, but at least we won't be writing to a wrong file. And in fact, to support this, Linux file systems store a generation number in their inodes, And this is only to implement things like NFS. There's no actual other use for this. Questions about this generation number idea? Okay. So this trick of sort of having these file IDs, which are information for the server that are being stashed in the client, turns NFS into what we will call a stateless protocol. That each operation stands alone. That each of these operations, we only need the information that's in here. We don't need any persistent information between calls. With open, for example, that wouldn't quite work. You know, we have to like remember what we previously opened, so we don't provide operations like that. And we're using this pattern that whenever we have an operation where we would like to store something locally, like when we open a file, we want to store like what file did I open? You know, where is it on disk? So I don't have to look it up each time. When we, read, we want to store what the offset is. We're requiring the client to do that now. The client needs to store these file IDs and track its offsets itself. And we can repeat this pattern over and over again. So for example, reader has the same problem. So the reader operation is that we have a file ID, an account, and we get that many entries, and we have a token which says, here's the next place where you can read things from the file. Which, I call an offset cookie. So this is, reader, we don't have a byte offset, but we expose something equivalent to that so we can remember where in the directory we are. And this idea lets us have multiple reader calls, like get different parts of a big directory. And the client just stores these tokens. The client doesn't care what it means. So the server can store whatever it wants in there. It can store a byte offset. Maybe it stores like a cluster number. It's like fat. But this is just gives the server the ability to stash whatever information it wants on the client without having to worry about how long do I keep that information around, because it's the client's responsibility. So we call this idea here of, each of these operations standing alone, I mentioned, a stateless protocol. So a stateless protocol, the server, the key thing is the server doesn't remember anything about clients between messages. In the case of our network file server, of course we remember something between messages because we have a file system. That's the purpose of our server. But we don't actually track what the clients are doing with it. We just have independent operations that, can be done at any time and don't depend on previous operations having been processed by the server in any particular way. So this is why we use things like file IDs stashed to the client instead of something like a file descriptor. So these are known as stateless protocols. Another common example that is HTTP is a stateless protocol. HTTP has requests. Each HTTP request, is independent. The server doesn't actually, for the HTTP protocol, the server doesn't actually need to, keep track of what happened in the previous request. And like with NFS in HTTP, you may have known about cookies, and cookies are the idea that, if I want to actually keep track of something between different operations, I'm going to have the client remember something. Cookies are HTTP's mechanism for that, kind of like file IDs are in NFS. And, that kind of pattern appears all over the place. So there are also protocols which are stateful. So for example, two-phase commit, you previous things that happened really matter. Like the prepare operation and the commit operation, are very connected to each other. And, the things that are receiving those operations really, care about one happening after the other and absolutely need to remember things that happened before. Okay. And You know, this is actually a big decision when designing distributed systems, is whether to use a stateful or stateless protocol. And sort of, you often will want to prefer a stateless protocol, because even though it's more work for clients, like it was less straightforward to implement our NFS client, we had to keep track of things for the server, it's less work for the server, and while the server needs to handle a lot of clients, and the client doesn't. So often you'll deliberately design protocols that way, but there are kind of disadvantages with that. Kind of think about those disadvantages. Let's go through this question. So I want a stateless file server. Which of these things can I implement with a stateless file server? And give another 15, 20 seconds. Okay, so let's go through these. So A, I think is possible, just big RPCs, but maybe not practical. You know, so this is possible. We can just have a big sort of single request. Yet, like stateless doesn't mean the requests aren't big operations. Though maybe it's not practical to have like an RPC where we upload a 10 gig file. For B, this is possible, and this seems non-intuitive because you're thinking, wait a moment, doesn't the server need to know the client wants to get updates for this file? But it doesn't. And the solution is the client contacts the server, say, every 30 seconds. So every 30 seconds, the client asks the server, hey, is the file updated? So that is possible. But you might say that this solution seems awfully expensive. So it's possible, but we see sort of a possible but inefficient. We see a problem with insisting on this stateless design. Another C is doing an open without risking inconsistency if the client is also modifying the directories containing the file. So I think this is a no. And the problem is, you know, what if someone else removes the file? Someone removes, renames, just before open. The only way we could tell is by talking to the server. The server can't tell us about it because the server doesn't know that we're interested in the file. So it can't do that. This case is probably would be possible because of the condition. Because the idea is that, you know, if client knew to retrieve the directory information beforehand. So this is possible, but yeah, we have to have, the client needs to know to retrieve the directory info beforehand, and as no one else is changing it, it can do the open operation without contacting the server. It can't read or write yet, but it can at least, like, figure out, you know, that yes, you can open that file. So questions on sort of my conclusions for each of these. So something that this last point here, these last two bring up, are, you know, that if we want to provide consistency, that we want it to be the case that if I move a, rename a file and then try to open it, like, it looks the same everywhere, that I don't, like, on one machine I can't open the, under the old name, then it seems like with this stateless protocol, we definitely need to talk to the server a lot. Or if we want to, like, figure out if a file is updated, we need to talk to the server a lot. And this is kind of actually a problem for performance. If we were thinking about on the local file system, previously we'd go to the cache, our page cache, and that would be really fast. And that would take, like, microseconds. So yes, disks are slow, but we weren't accessing the disk. We were accessing, you know, a cache most of the time. Now it takes milliseconds because when we open a file, we have to ask the server if it's okay. When you read from a file, we have to get it from the server in case someone just wrote it. Now you might say, well, why aren't we caching? And we can do that, but the problem is, what about other changes? So let's say I'm caching a file here and someone writes it. So the solution I alluded to with the detecting updates within 60 seconds is that we could, you know, just ask over and over again. Did it change? Did it change? Did it change? If we want to detect updates immediately, we have to ask for every read. And that's, you know, that's going to help, but it's not going to help very much. Because, well, most of our cost is not getting this little text file. Most of the cost is actually, you know, waiting, getting the answer about did it change from the server. Another thing about caching is that when we write a file, you know, if I update my cache copy, locally I'm used to writing it back to the hard drive a bit later. Here it seems like I have to tell the server right away, you know, in order for someone else reading it to actually see my changes. And this sort of issue that, you know, it seems like we need to ask the server a lot to make sure we, you know, have up-to-date versions, and we have to tell the server immediately about changes, seems to suggest that, you know, yes, we can cache things, but we're not really going to get any benefit because we have to always check if we want things to be consistent before using a cache version. We have to write all the updates to the server right away. This allows our stateless protocol, but is a reason why there are some commonly used file network file protocols which aren't stateless. Because, you know, this destroys the benefit of caching. Like, we're paying almost all of our cost just to, like, check if the cache is up to date. You know, we might as well have not cached almost. Now, NFS version 3, the version after version 2, allows caching. But it's still stateless. You might ask, well, how do they do that and make it actually worth caching things? And their solution was one you might not like, and that's that they allow some inconsistency. So they just say, we're going to allow inconsistency, but not all the inconsistency. And their trick was that they update the server on close and check the cache again on open. And they decided that this was probably good enough. Another solution that some network file systems use is you don't have the server be stateless anymore. You have the server remember who's interested in the file, even though this creates lots of tricky problems with what if a client goes to sleep. You might say, so why did NFS decide to do this idea? And the sort of motivation behind, you know, only check on open and close is that as long as a user is loading and saving a file all at once, you'll still get consistency by doing this, but this allows you to do a lot of caching. So that's the compromise they made. Okay. So they allow inconsistency if you two people are writing and reading the file at once, but if they're, you know, as long as you open, you know, before, you know, after changes have been made and you close after you make changes, everything will be fine. And that's the compromise they made. So questions about this consistency model, this compromise to support caching despite insisting on statelessness. So the reason for using stateless is to maybe give less work for the servers? Yeah, so giving less work for the servers is the primary reason. And note that a lot of the work is, you know, the complexity of dealing with what if a client has a problem. Does that answer your question? Yeah, and there are stateful protocols. We're not going to talk about them this semester. I believe Arpeggio goes into AFS, which is an example of one that uses a stateful solution to allow caching. Okay, so that's where I'm going to stop talking about distributed systems. And our next topic is going to be our brief interlude into operating system security issues. And to talk about that, I'm going to talk about two cab terms. There's going to be about protection versus security. When I use the word protection, I'm talking about mechanisms for controlling access to resources. So for example, page tables are a mechanism for providing memory protection. That a page table controls what memory, what physical memory you can access, and therefore protects access to memory. But this is separate from security, which is using protection in the case of OSs to prevent misuse of these resources. So the security we're going to get is that we're going to set up our page tables so you can't access memory that contains data you're not supposed to access. And in this class, we're going to talk mainly about mechanisms. So we're going to talk mainly about ways of providing protection and not about the actual security properties we want to achieve. So our main goal is going to be to provide enough flexibility to support whatever the actual policy is. And we're gonna be talking about, you know, how we can provide some nice, really flexible mechanisms for controlling access to resources that will allow us to do whatever policies the system administrators want. But in this class, we aren't gonna talk that much about what a good policy would be. And yeah, I give page tables as an example. So page tables are super flexible, right? We can configure a process to have access to whatever it wants. We can also configure whether it can read or write things. So they're an example of a really nice policy. And yeah, I've got security. Now, one important thing about protection mechanisms in this context is that we're going to be talking about security to prevent misuse, and our misuse we're going to assume is done by what I'll call adversaries. Adversaries are going to do the worst possible thing. So for example, with page tables, you might have thought of the main role of page tables as, well, page tables having invalid entries is that if I have a bogus pointer, it triggers a segfault and crashes my program. And that's sort of acceptable as far as, you know, preventing bugs, but that's not what we're going to care about when we think about this misuse. Our misuse is going to be someone who does the worst possible thing. So if there is one page that we have set wrong in the page table, they're going to find it. They're not going to fiddle around and accidentally access invalid memory. That's not what we're talking about preventing. We're talking about preventing someone who's clever and can, you know, find that one invalid page table entry, that one, you know, misset, you know, permission bit in the page table and take advantage of it. They're going to do the worst possible thing, the most, you know, that's going to cause us to do something wrong. So it's not about preventing mistakes. This is about preventing deliberate misuse. And that's a lot harder, obviously, than, you know, just catching a mistake. Now, commonly, our policies are going to specify something like, I don't want the wrong people to get this information. And that means that we're going to want to have some sort of notion of what user, in some sense, what person or what entity, you know, is represent a particular process or something like that, you know, represents. And this gives us two notions. I'll call one authentication and one authorization. So authentication is determining who is who. Am I me or not? Whereas authorization is determining who can do what. And we're going to be focusing, you know, this is our focus. So we're going to assume, you know, assume already done. We're going to assume that someone else does the authentication and tells us about it. I'll give you a mechanism for how they tell us about it. And our main concern is once we've figured out who is who, how do we determine what they're allowed to do? So, as I said, I'm not going to deal with how authentication works, but to like give a very concrete example, sort of using a password, that's authentication. That's trying to identify who is who. We're not going to deal with exactly how it works in this class. We're just going to deal with tracking it after it's done. So the OS is going to be told, yes, they entered the right password, or they provided a smart card to identify who they were, and we're just going to track it afterwards. So how do we do this authorization? And I'm going to talk about some very generic mechanisms, and then we're going to talk about things we can actually implement that are less abstract. So here's a very generic abstract mechanism known as an access control matrix. And the idea is that this represents our authorization decision. So we're going to say that we have a bunch of what I'll call protection domains. And we're going to assign processes to these domains. And typically this will represent like a user or a group of users. But I'm leaving this very generic because we can have flexibility, you know, as far as what it is. The important thing is that processes are assigned one or more of these rows. And for every object, everything that the process may or may not be allowed to access, we have a list of operations allowed for that protection domain here. So here, there's a file that everyone can read and users that belong to domain one can write. Here we have a process that users that belong to domain two can wake up and users that belong to domain three are allowed to kill. Okay. So this is our sort of abstract representation. And most of what we'll be talking about is like storing some concrete subset of this information or some concrete version of this in a compact way. So you can think of, well, I could fill out this whole table, but that's going to be ridiculously big because how many objects do we have with a million files? But we're going to represent this information in some way, and our operating system is going to enforce the policies expressed in this access control matrix, however it's stored. Now, before we talk about sort of exactly the sort of more compact representation we'll use for this information in this table, we can talk about like what are these rows? What are these protection domains actually, and how do we represent that information? So I said, each process belongs to them. How do we track that? And the most common way that OSs do it is with something known as a user identifier. So this is typically a number that's assigned to each user, and the OS is going to track this for each process. So each process has a user ID. If each process has one, this is in the process control block. And once this is set, this user ID is used to decide what the process is authorized to do. So when we make, for example, an open system call or a kill system call, you know, check user ID plus the access control matrix. So the OS will enforce this based on the user ID stored in the process control block. And this is, in fact, the Unix way of doing this. So on POSIX, every process has actually multiple user IDs, but the important one is called the effective user ID. And this is set, you can retrieve this with get EUID. It's a unique number. We just assign a number for every user. And this is used in this permission checks, and this is stored as part of the process role. You might say, this is a number, but I don't log into my system by typing in a number. So there is a mapping from these numbers to names, but this is actually not maintained by the kernel. So the kernel only knows about the number typically, but there are standard programs and libraries that maintain the number to name mapping. So the number to name mapping is entirely done outside the kernel. The kernel doesn't track names, it just tracks these numbers. And that's done because that's all it's going to care about. So in addition to user IDs, POSIX also supports groups. And the idea with groups is that you can like set something for all faculty by assigning all faculty to a particular group. So like user IDs, there's also group IDs. And that's just another protection domain that the user is assigned to. And if you run on a POSIX system, you can, like, say, our department machines, you can run, for example, there's usually an ID command, and here the ID command shows that here's my user ID, here's my, and here are my group IDs. And this information, ID could get it because it's stored in the process control blocks of every program I'm running. When I fork, it copies the IDs. So, you know, they're just set when I log in. Okay. And these names here, they're just looked up in a database. The kernel doesn't actually know about them. The question is, what domain takes priority if they have conflicting permissions? That is a decision which varies. And we're not going to talk about the specific choices, I think. You need to make a choice, but yeah, it varies what systems do for that. Now, something about these groups look like they're just providing the same information as my user ID. Sometimes they don't do that. So for example, sometimes you might have a group for access to the monitor, and you might give this group to processes run by a user logging in directly, but not SSHing it. So the groups don't necessarily have to be more information about the user. They can just be extra information about what a particular process is allowed to do. Now, this is a nice theoretical idea, doesn't actually work great in practice, because what if I just keep a program running in the background? Okay. So I talked about these protection domains. So we have these users and groups with IDs in the kernel, in kernel's process control blocks, and the name mapping stored outside. Then we have to represent this table here. And there's sort of two common ways. So one idea is what's known as an access control list, that with each object, so alongside each file, for example, we store a list of some sort of who is allowed to use each item and what they're allowed to do. An alternate idea, which some systems do use, is that we could have like a list of, you know, domain object permissions stored on the side. And this is sometimes done, but Most commonly, we'll store them with the objects that are being accessed. And this is what POSIX does for files, and we'll primarily talk about files, even though this idea also applies to things like processes. So POSIX supports a very restricted access control list. By very restricted, I mean restricted in the sense of what you can actually store in it. So what POSIX supports is you can specify a user ID, which is the owner, and that user has a read, write, or execute permission, and also always has the ability to change the permissions. So they effectively have all the permissions. You can store one group ID, and also whether they can read, write, or execute. You can set each of those separately, and you can afford a default setting for someone who doesn't match any of these, whether they can read, write, or execute. And if you've used the chmod command, this is what the chmod command manipulates. So compared to what I showed here, this seems very limited, and it is, but it is technically an example of this model. We've just, heavily restricted what we're allowed to put in each of these columns. Now, POSIX and other file systems sometimes support more flexible access control lists. POSIX support has a version that's standardized, but it's usually not supported. Sometimes it is. And NTFS uses this. And in this more flexible version, rather than having only one user ID and one group ID, we'll just have a list. So for example, in the flexible but not always supported access control list, we can specify, hey, students can read and not execute, faculty can read, write, and execute, and user MST3KA can read, write, and execute, and user TJ1A can do nothing. So this is sort of a configuration file. When this is stored on disk, these actually turn into numbers, because remember, the kernel that only knows about numbers, but we have a number for the group students, a number for the group user MST3K, and we're going to store those. And there's a question of what about conflicting permissions? So POSIX rule for these full access control lists is that the user takes precedence over groups. So TJ1A, if they're a student or faculty, can't do anything. MST3K, if they're a student, can still write. But that's a rule they had to make. So we have these sort of we have these limited access control lists that are supported everywhere, and this more flexible model, which is kind of like what our ideal of this way of storing the permissions are. That we just have a list, and we're just going through this table and representing everything in this column, in that list. Questions about sort of storing our access control matrix this way. So now that we've stored the information, the question is, when do we check it? And the answer is that on Unix, the pattern is we do this on system call entry. We can't do it in the library because, a user could call the system call directly. So it has to be done in the kernel on system call entry. And, we just need to make sure every single system call actually checks these permissions. If we miss one or we get the check wrong, well, that's too bad. We have a big problem. And this is the typical strategy. So we're going to look at the permissions that are stored in that, that chmod information or the access control list. And we're going to compare it to the current processes control block and the IDs stored in there and figure out, is this allowed or is this not? Okay, so talk about checking access. Now, let's talk about introducing, how are we going to actually set up these user IDs and processes? And before to talk about that, I want to talk about a special user ID. So user ID 0 is going to be special. This is on POSIX systems. This is going to be known as either super user or root. And this is special in that they have access to as sort of a hard-coded access control list, is that user ID 0 can do anything, pretty much. And the way you can think about this in terms of our access control model is that it's like we have a a UID 0 here, and every entry in the list is anything. So user ID 0 on system calls sort of passes all, or at least almost all, permission checks. And including ones that are often reserved for UID 0, like shutting down the system, that we don't want to just let just anyone do. And this special user is used for sort of system administrator stuff, and it's also going to be a way we can make our sort of login program work. So let's think about logging into a system. So, you know, I have my machine, type user ID and a password, and I get a shell that's running as my user. So what is this? What is this? This is a program. This is not the kernel typically. This is just a normal program that runs. It checks the password and then changes user IDs and then runs a shell. And you might say, how can it change user IDs? This is going to be allowed for the special UID 0. We allow UID 0 to bypass permission checks. One of the checks we'll allow it to bypass is the one for, are you allowed to change user IDs? It's going to be allowed to. Now you might say, how is it going to check if the password is correct? And since it's just a program, you know, the kernel doesn't actually get involved, but you know, there's a typical pattern for how this is done in Unix. And the most common way this is done in Unix is by storing a database of passwords in a on a single user system in a file that is only readable by root. So you have a file where we've set its access control list so only root can access it. On our department machines, we have a network service. So the program will contact some server on the network and say, is this password correct, basically. And you have a question, is this program like PAM on Linux? So so there's something called PAM that exists on Linux and some other Unixes, which is sort of a wrapper for what this for either versions of these code. Does that answer your question? Okay. So we check password. How about changing the user IDs? So in POSIX, I mentioned that, you know, the user ID we can get as part of a password. So there's a system call, a library call. It's typically just a system call called setUID, which sets the user ID. If you're a super user, it just sets it to whatever you want. If you're not super user, it mostly doesn't work. It does work in some special cases we'll talk about later. So basically, the login program starts a super user, and it just calls setUID once you log in. So that's how that works. So that solves our question of, like, how do we actually set up the user? You know, but then we have another puzzle. So if you've used our VMs, there's a sudo command which runs things with super user permissions. This means it runs it as UID 0. And it verifies a password first, at least, but there's a question of, like, how can it do that? Because I can't just let any program call setUID 0 and have it work. Because then all my permission checks would be pointless. An adversary would just call setUID 0 and do whatever bad things they want to do. And this is running for my shell. When my shell forks, it doesn't have a UID of 0. So how does this work? So POSIX has a feature to support programs like sudo. Sudo is like a really handy program. We want the ability to actually run things as root sometimes, but in a limited fashion. And the solution for that is that there's an extra bit on executables called the setUserID bit, which is part of the things you can set with chmod. And if this is set, exec checks that bit and changes the effective user ID to the owner's ID. So the sudo program owned by root marks that user ID, so it runs as root. And that's okay as long as the sudo program is written correctly. Because the sudo program, we know, is going to check the password, for example. And going to figure out, you know, is this yearning as a user who I want to allow to run, say, the restart command. And this set user ID idea gives us a lot of flexibility in a way where we didn't have to burden the kernel. The kernel doesn't need to know who's allowed to run restart. Sudo can know it outside the kernel. Kernel doesn't need to know how to verify passwords. That's all done outside the kernel. And we just have this general mechanism the kernel implements where you can write this set user ID program that serves a gate to higher privilege. It gives us controlled access to more functionality. And we can kind of think of it similar to like a system call gives us controlled access to things that can only be done in kernel mode. This set user ID program gives us controlled access to things that can only be done by root. So only root can restart the system. That's okay. Sudo gives us controlled access to the restart operation. And set user ID programs are all over the place on Unix-like systems. So for example, mounting a USB stick on a Linux system will typically be done by a set user ID program. And this program is going to, you know, access this mount system call that typically is only allowed for root, but it's going to make some checks before it does that. It's going to make sure you aren't mounting in a way which is going to replace some sensitive directories. Then you aren't going to mess up normal hard disks. So even though this command can be used to mount a normal hard disk, we're not going to let you do that. We're going to make sure we call mount in a way which prevents you from having more set user ID programs on it that the system administrator doesn't want. Another example is accessing devices. So if we want to talk to a monitor or a printer, we might not allow users to do that directly, but we can have a program which does that and makes decisions about, like, you know, making sure that you aren't printing a million pages. You want to write to a log file, for example. There's all these other things where, you know, the kernel has made this very simple decision that only root or some other user can do something. And if we want to make more precise decisions, like, yes, you can make mount new disks, but only USB sticks, not normal hard drives. We can do that with this general mechanism. And as I mentioned, this is sort of kind of like, you know, the hardware says some things are only for the kernel, so you have system calls to do them. The kernel has said some things are only for root. We can have set user ID programs to do them. Now, set user ID programs seem like a nice mechanism, but they're a bit tricky. Mostly, they're really tricky to write well. Let me give you a scenario. So let's say I have a directory with grades on a shared server, and I have a folder for each assignment, and I have a text file with each user's grades. And I have to deal with bad access control lists, so I can't actually easily set each user can access their own grade. So instead, what I'm going to do is I'm going to write a program to read their grade. So they're going to run this print grade program, the assignment, and it's going to output their grade. Okay, it's going to just fill in their user here, and it's filling in their user, so they can't just output anyone's grade. And I'm doing this because I don't have a way of setting access control lists specifically for each file because it's just not flexible enough. I don't have that full, you know, general list each user. I only have like chmod, which is really, you know, really limited. So here's my really broken program. So this program is horribly insecure. Can someone name one reason why? Like, if I had this as my set user ID program, things can go incredibly wrong. Okay, so one thing people mention is I'm retrieving the username from an environment variable, Well, not, yeah, so this is, you know, can be changed. So this environment variable user usually matches the username, but that's not actually guaranteed. Because it's just set for convenience. If you actually, you know, we should instead look up in user database. Question is, would the FD being closed not be a problem? The FD not being closed is fine because the program exits after main. And that will close it automatically. So, one observation that's made is that we can overflow this buffer. So, if you've taken a course that talked about buffer overflows, that's really bad. Okay. What if I did star as my file name? So, you're right to be concerned about this argv1 here. What if it's bad? Star isn't actually a problem because if you pass it to open, it doesn't get interpreted as like a matching thing. But there are other file names we could pass which would be really bad, like say ..... .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. Or, what's worse, is that I can set up a symbolic link in a directory and point to that in that way. So that would be really bad. And there's one big subtlety that people missed, is that I'm opening this read-write, and you might say, that's weird. Could that be a problem? And, well, it seems like not. I'm only reading from the file. But observation is that I'm writing to standard out. Now, what's standard out? Write to standard out equals, you know, file descriptor 1. And could the return value of open be 1? The answer is it could if this is run without standard out open. So we could actually write to the grade file if we were really careful, or some other file by closing standard out before running this program. So all sorts of things that are wrong, and this is only in a very short program. So writing set user ID programs is real, really tricky. And there's another special way in which it's tricky, and that's because of a common thing we want to do when we're writing programs. Let me give you an example of, let's say I have a program to access a printer, which just takes a file to print. So my idea for that might be, okay, let's check if you can open that file, then open it, read it, write it to the printer, and close it. So this is for my set user ID program, which does that. And like with my simple program here, you know, even though I'm being even more careful here, this is going to have some big problems. And there's a big problem here, which is a race condition. So the race condition is that, you know, I call the set user ID program to print a file. I say print to print.txt. The set user ID program checks, can I access it? Then what I do is I erase the file and make something else be that file. On Unix systems, I can use /link to make a new directory entry that points to an existing file. If I didn't have that, I could rename a file, remove it. I can make a symbolic link, which is kind of like an alias that Linux supports and Unix supports for convenience. Or if none of that worked, I could write a program that creates a file in that location with that name. For example, if my password changing program writes a temporary file, I can write my own temporary file with the same name, start printing it, and then quickly run the password changing program, you know, in this little time window here. And the problem is, now when we open this, we're opening some secret file. So this is known as a time-to-check to time-of-use vulnerability. So POSIX has sort of a nice solution to this to help you write set user ID programs, which is that you can temporarily change users back to the original user. So this answers and then change back to the set user ID user. So rather than doing this solution, we can say change to original user, open, change back. And open will do our permissions check and we'll make sure we aren't accessing a file the user isn't allowed to access. And for this reason, POSIX has multiple user IDs. So when I talked about user IDs initially, I said we had get EUID is the effective one. Also has a real and a saved user ID in order to support this swap out the user ID temporarily for things like this, where we want to, you know, be able to, you know, take in a file but not access it with our extra permissions. Okay. And so that's where I will leave off for today. So, any questions about this time to check to time of use problem? Doesn't click it.